In 1912, we had Theodore Roosevelt decided to run for office again, and he created the Bull Moose Party. And the Bull Moose Party really created a disruption in the Republican Party. It split the Republican Party votes in the country and also in New Hampshire. And just as in the country, you know, Woodrow Wilson was elected president in 1912, a Democrat. In New Hampshire, we elected a Democratic governor and a Democratic state legislature, both in the House and the Senate. And when they came into session in 1913, one of the first things they did was to create a presidential primary for New Hampshire. And that primary was to be held on the third Tuesday in May. They figured that if we wait till the end, we can be the one that chooses. You know, maybe just two or three other candidates left, and we can choose. We'll be the kingmaker by making that final decision on who's going to be. But something else took sway, and that was New Hampshire, maybe New England, it's called New England frugality. And they realized if they had it on town meeting day instead of the third Tuesday in May, it would be one less election that they would have to pay for. And so in 1915, the New Hampshire legislature decided to change the date of the primary from May to town meeting day, which was the second Tuesday in May, or March. So in 1916, New Hampshire had its first presidential primary. The very first, 1 week after Indiana had its primary, and the same day as Minnesota held its primary. But in the next 4 years, Indiana decided, we'll move our primary to May. And Minnesota decided to move to a caucus system. And so New Hampshire became the first presidential primary. It was as easy as that. It wasn't because we staked a claim and said, we're going to be first. It was because Indiana said, we don't want to do this anymore. We're going to do it. So in 1920, the very first New Hampshire presidential primary, or I'm sorry, the second New Hampshire primary, but the very first, it was first. So this year, in fact, marks 100 years since we've been the first New Hampshire, or the first presidential primary. All right, there was a big, it was not the same. The election is not as how we know it. And for instance, here's a ballot from the 1920 New Hampshire primary. What's the first thing you notice about it? Think about it.
Winchester?
Winchester, yeah. But what's different? Think about how we define states. Red states, blue states. The Republican ballot was blue. And the Democratic ballot was pink.
They still are in Massachusetts.
Really?
Which must drive polling workers nuts these days.
Well, at any rate, that was minor. But the real difference in the primary, I'm just going to shift this to my next picture here. And let's just bring it up a little bit here so you can all see it. Is, if you look at that carefully, there's really no box to check your presidential candidate. That's because the primary was not about voting for president, it was about voting for the delegates to go to the national convention who would in turn vote for the president. And so if you look right there, it says, for instance, Frank Knox, Manchester, pledged to vote for the nomination of Leonard Wood for president. And all of the New Hampshire delegates were pledged to vote for Leonard Wood. But not that they weren't all pledged, but all the ones that were pledged. So, you know, we're a small town up in New Hampshire. You knew that, okay, Charles Toby is going to the convention. He's probably going to vote for so-and-so. And so people just knew if they voted for this guy, it was an indirect vote. But it was not a direct vote for president of the United States. Now, let me just point out a couple of things here, because I love continuity in politics. And we'll test your New Hampshire wisdom, or your wisdom about New Hampshire. All right. Frank Knox. How many people know who Frank Knox was? Go for it.
Is he the guy who's created that town, Knox, that votes first in New Hampshire at midnight?
No.
Somebody told me it did that.
No. The town that voted first in New Hampshire is actually Dixville, Notch, not Knox. It's N-O-T-C-H, Notch. No, Frank Knox. Okay, well, again, everything is connected. Teddy Roosevelt, as you remember, was a Rough Rider. The Cuban, the Spanish American War, the Rough Riders. Frank Knox was one of his Rough Rider friends. And in fact, so was Leonard Wood. Leonard Wood was a Rough Rider. But what Frank Knox did was, in 1912, he moved to Manchester, New Hampshire, and started a newspaper which was called the Manchester Evening Leader. And the purpose of that newspaper was to promote the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt in the 1912 election. But Frank, after that election, stayed around in New Hampshire. He got involved in New Hampshire politics, and he owned the Union Leader the Manchester Leader. He owned that until 1947. He went on to be the vice presidential candidate with Alf Brandon as the presidential candidate in, I think, the 1928 election. And after that, during World War, he was named by Franklin Roosevelt as the Secretary of the Navy. So he was Secretary of the Navy during World War II until he died. He died not in 1947, he died in 1943, but his wife still owned the paper for 3 more years. Anyway, John Wynand. John Wynand, second one down over here. Anybody know who John Wynand was? Some of you all know New Hampshire guys. John Wynand was a governor of New Hampshire. 3 terms, but more importantly, John Wynand went on to be the United States Ambassador to Great Britain during World War II. And John Wynand is probably the most celebrated American in Great Britain to this day. So anyway, yeah.
A couple of things. So looking at the towns that they're from, I'm guessing that this was a statewide slate. It's not by congressional district.
Statewide.
And the other thing that just strikes me is that that year, this is 1920, right?
Right.
So Warren Harding was the nominee and ultimately president, and nobody is claiming to be for him in this.
You know what? I just got this today. I called up our state archives and asked if they could send me a copy of the ballot. And I haven't heard of it. And what Leonard Wood actually was. He was pushed by the people because Roosevelt had died. They went to Leonard Wood, who was actually second in command under Roosevelt during the Rough Rider years. And so there was a move to make him, and he actually almost got it. But what happened was that they went into 4 different ballots in the 1920s.
Oh, was he from New Hampshire?
And Warren G. Harding got it on the 4th ballot. Yeah. Good question, though. All right. So, we've got this election that's meaningless in some ways. And in 1948, people in newspapers, specifically in New Hampshire, started saying, what the world is this thing is all about? Let's make it a little more serious. And so, a move was made to change the structure of the primary. And that move was started and pioneered by a man named Richard Upton. And I'm not going to ask you if you know who Richard Upton is. I'm going to show you who Richard Upton is. And I will just preface it by saying that Richard Upton, with the Upton family in Concord, is a very prominent legal family. His father was a lawyer, and his son, and I think his grandson, are lawyers in Concord still to this day. Richard is no longer alive. But he was elected at a young age to the House of Representatives. It was kind of the thing that lawyers did back in those days. Before you become a lawyer, you have to do your good deed and do so as a service to the state. So he's elected to the state legislature, and became Speaker of the New Hampshire House. And then I'll let him tell the rest of the story.
So in the 1949 legislature, when I was elected Speaker, fortunately, I saw to it that a bill was introduced. I didn't, at that time, feel that the Speaker should introduce a bill under his own name. So I had a friend of mine, Reuben Moore of Bradford, sponsor the bills. He agreed with me about it. And I wrote the bills out on one weekend, some of it on the back of an envelope.
Richard Upton's bill did essentially 2 things. First, it put the names of presidential candidates on the ballot in a preference poll or beauty contest. Secondly, it allowed for the inclusion of a candidate's name on the ballot by petition with 100 signatures, unless a candidate specifically asked not to be on the ballot.
I guess the idea is to force the presidential candidates into the field whether they want to or not.
The bill passed both houses of the legislature with voice votes and full support of both Democratic and Republican leadership. On May 11, 1949, Governor Sherman Adams signed the bill creating the New Hampshire presidential preference primary.
He wasn't too sure that he ought to sign it. I went in, he called me in and said, "What does this bill mean?" And we went over the possible consequences. I think we discussed how it might impact on various upcoming candidates. I gave it as my opinion that it would quicken the interest of the voters, that there would be a real, I hoped, a real lively contest, and that our state would be put on the map.
So, if you're going to pick one person who's responsible for the New Hampshire primary being what it is, Richard Upton is the man. He was the one that put it in motion. Now, just as an interesting aside, Richard talked about how when he was young and it was a different kind of politician. I did that interview with him in 1986. And to my knowledge, it was the first time he ever sat down and did a formal interview with anybody about his role in creating the New Hampshire primary. Very modest man, not into talking a lot. Just another aside, I hope you don't mind. When I talk, I like to kind of share some stories that went into the producing of the documentary. So you saw those pieces, you know, the actual bill that went through the legislature and then the actual state statute. So when I did this, you know, digital technology wasn't part of the reality. So you needed your camera to go in there and do moves and so on. And I went to our state archives and they dug this stuff out for me and I said, "Can I borrow these?" And they actually let me take them home for the weekend. I was nervous a little bit about it, but no, that was, he knew me, the state archivist knew me, and he trusted me, but, you know, you don't find that happening very much with historical documents anymore. Sure, take it home, just be careful. At any rate, so, now it's in place for 1952, but let's be clear about one thing. It was a beauty contest. It was not an election. There was absolutely zero connection between how many delegates a candidate would get and how many votes they got in the primary. You still had all the names of the potential delegates on the ballot, and so you really had to vote twice. You had to vote for your beauty contest choice for president, and then you had to vote for your delegates. And you pretty much, again, knew if these delegates were supporting this candidate or that candidate or that candidate. No connection, though, between the two. So when they say beauty contest, it really was a beauty contest, and that's all. So on the Republican side, you had several candidates, but the primary candidate was Robert Taft, who was from Ohio, son of William Howard Taft, and known as Mr. Republican. But the candidate that people really wanted was a man named Dwight Eisenhower. And Dwight Eisenhower, as you know, was Commander-in-Chief of World War II, of Allied forces. And at that point in time, he was Supreme Commander of NATO and stationed in Europe. And politics was below him. He was not going to come and declare himself to run for president. He wasn't going to come to New Hampshire and campaign. That was what people of a lower class did. This guy was probably the most well-known hero in the world at that moment in time. But think about the structure of the primary. He didn't have to come to New Hampshire and put his name on the ballot. People in New Hampshire that wanted him to be president could do that for him. And the only decisive thing he needed to do would be take his name off the ballot, which, and again, would indicate his interest in politics, and that's below him. So it was perfectly set up to promote a candidacy for somebody like Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower never came to New Hampshire to campaign, never even admitted or referenced that there was a campaign going on. And what would happen is people would come around and they would have debates between Eisenhower and Taft. And there would be the representative for Taft, and there would be the representative for Taft and Eisenhower, and then they would have a debate. And that was how the voters would decide who they would vote for based on these surrogates. And the leading surrogate in that mission for Eisenhower was a man named Sherman Adams. Do people here remember Sherman Adams? I see a few nods. He was governor of New Hampshire at the time. But then, as the primary date got closer, Taft decided he would make a trip to New Hampshire and meet the voters. Now, Robert Taft was very distinguished. You know, he was one of the leaders of the United States Senate, and he wasn't somebody you could thrust a chicken into his arms and have him embrace it. You know, he was very stiff, and he made a trip all the way up to northern New Hampshire to Colebrook and down, and he lost more votes than he gained because he had absolutely zero personality and zero interest in meeting people or talking to them. There is a picture of him holding a chicken, literally, and he just has the most disgusted look on his face, like, what the crap is this all about?
So how did he do Ohio?
Well, it was a different type of thing in those days. Campaigning was very different.
And this was 1948.
52. We're talking 52 now.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just saying you had to have some campaign skills.
You did have to get out, but what you would do, and you'll hear Richard Upton saying this in the next section, is that you would go to the party leaders and convince them, and once you, that was all you needed. You didn't go out and need to talk to the masses. You just went to the party leaders and convinced them, you know, the leaders in each little town, and then they would get out to vote for you. So it wasn't as one-on-one as it was. So that's the Republican side. And it was important to Republicans to win in 1952 because the previous five presidential elections had gone Democrat for the White House. Four times for Franklin Roosevelt and once for Harry Truman. So it was really important for the Republicans to kind of get back in the White House. And I should also add that a year before, nobody even knew what party Dwight Eisenhower was a part of. And what finally happened was in late 1951, Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the senator from Massachusetts at the time, went over to Europe and met with Eisenhower and got Eisenhower to say that if he was going to be a part, if he was in a party, if he was going to be public about it, it would be the Republican Party. So Lodge came back to New York and actually held a press conference to say Dwight Eisenhower is a Republican. He's ours, Democrats, too bad. I didn't say it like that, but that's what he was thinking, I'm sure. At any rate, but we're not going to talk about the Republican primary more than that. We're going to talk about the Democratic primary. Now, I know that you guys are a Democratic state down here. And New Hampshire, for many, many years, was a very staunch Republican state, as you may know. And this was particularly true and probably at its peak in 1952. We had a United States Senator named Stiles Bridges, who was elected to the Senate in 1934 and served until his death in 1961. And in that time, no Democrat in New Hampshire was elected to a statewide office. That was the control that the Republican Party had in New Hampshire. Now, on the national level, we had Harry Truman as president, but nobody really knew if Harry Truman was going to run for another term. Some people thought he might, some people thought he wouldn't, and one of the people who thought he wouldn't was a man named Estes Kefauver. Anybody know that name, Estes Kefauver? All right, other than Richard Upton, Estes Kefauver is the most important person in the history of the primary, in my opinion. Estes Kefauver was a senator from Tennessee, and he was chairman of the Senate Select Committee investigating interstate crime, basically the mafia. And if you know the movie The Godfather, the Godfather 2, there's that scene in the Senate. Well, that was a recreation or a fictional portrayal of that committee. And it was also the first congressional committee to have their hearings televised. And so he's being seen all over the country in a way that no politician in that capacity had ever been seen before. And they were very dramatic hearings. I remember as I was going through archival footage of the hearings, I came across a clip where Charles Tobey, who was actually at that time a senator from New Hampshire, and he was the ranking Republican on the committee, was questioning Paul O'Dwyer, who was the mayor of New York. And Dwyer was making the accusation that Tobey had gotten money from the mob. And Tobey says, I never got any kind of money like that. I never got anything like that. And O'Dwyer says, well, I'm under oath, Senator, and you're not. I mean, that's how contentious those meetings were. And I have to tell you, that's quite a bold statement. You know, I'm under oath and you're not, Mr. United States Senator. At any rate, so this is the story of the Democratic side and Estes Kefauver. So Estes wanted to, basically, he wasn't sure if Truman was going to run, but he kind of had an inkling that Truman was going to run. And so he wanted to put himself in a good position so that when Truman said, I'm not going to run, they might look to Estes to be the candidate. And so he thought if he came up here and got involved and ran in New Hampshire and got a few votes in the New Hampshire primary, it would demonstrate his electability on a scale outside of Tennessee. And so that was his mission. So here's the story of the New Hampshire 1952 Democratic primary. You hear it all right?
I couldn't find any Democrats. And there was a little general store there, and the man kicked me out of the store when he heard that I was a Democrat. He said, we don't have any Democrats, and we don't allow them to stay here very long. Get.
In 1952, New Hampshire Democrats were at best fragmented, at worst a token opposition party that some believe was even run by Republicans. They hadn't held a major statewide office in over 15 years. Primary would open state Democrats to a new world of politics, and it would be a Democratic candidate who sparked the style of campaigning that has become the mark of the New Hampshire primary.
What did the mayor say?
He thanked me, that was about all.
How long were you there?
Not more than 10 minutes.
As chairman of the Senate Special Committee to investigate interstate crime, Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver became the nation's first political television star. Investigation marked the first live national television coverage of a congressional hearing. Americans from California to New Hampshire were tuning in. Believing that Harry Truman would not seek another term in office, Kefauver wanted to establish himself as a viable Democratic candidate for president, and he looked to the New Hampshire primary as the vehicle to do it.
Well, I was sitting quietly in the office one day and minding my own business, and a very strong conservative in Laconia called me up and said, Tom, he said, you know, Estes Kefauver's coming up here to the tavern to campaign next Sunday? I said, no. Well, he says, I think it's your duty as former Democratic mayor to go down and meet him. So I said, well, all right, maybe I should. So Merton and I went down.
Kefauver was the first Democratic senator that many in New Hampshire had ever seen. He was an anomaly, a Democrat who thought himself a winner. Though many owed their loyalties to the president, Kefauver quickly gained supporters, especially among women, many of whom had seen him on television during his committee hearings.
We all stood around a little knot. Hugh Bounds was there, Bernie Booten was there, I was there, and so was Myrtle. And what happened was that he said, well, now, Tom, you're going to help me be my chairman. I said, I can't be your chairman. I'm the county chairman. He looked around at Hughie Bounds and said, Hugh, you're going to help me? I said, Hugh, you can help me. You're the city chairman. At that time, all of a sudden, there was this little voice from the back of the group. It says, Senator, I'll help you. It was Mrs. Mack. He said, Madam Chairman.
He got this little boy hurt look on his face. Everybody was turning him down. And I thought, gee, this man comes, he's a senator, nobody will help him. They're crazy. I said, Senator, I'll help you. It was just on an impulse. Because the fact was, I was a registered Republican.
Kefauver brought a new style of campaigning to New Hampshire. It was personal, sometimes gimmicky, but voters liked it, and it made good copy for the national press covering the primary.
You know, he'd just go up the street with his big hand, and he was a big man. And, you know, just very casually, well, my name's Estes Kefauver, I'd like your help, and move right on. And they had a system that was, the Washington staff behind him was a gal getting a name, and then won a letter. We'd never seen anything like this.
And Estes would put on any kind of a hat. I'm not sure that was the best thing in the world, but he would. And he would, he got into everything there was. There was a, if we had a toboggan, he would ride in the toboggan. If there was an ice skater or something, he'd try to skate with him. And every kind of a gadget. We found an old fire truck, I think it was, down in Hooksett. And that was all rigged up with lights. And we run it up and down the street in Manchester at night, and Estes along there, tailing along with him, shaking hands with everybody that he could find.
Once he started it, everyone had to do it. And people expected to be courted in that way. In the old times, if you wanted to carry a community, you went to see five or six or four or five of the leaders, and sometimes fewer number. And if you could sell yourself to them, they would get out the vote in the town for you. But that isn't true anymore.
So when we think of New Hampshire in the presidential primary, people think of that one-on-one campaign and the candidates out there kind of really engaging. And it was Estes Kefauver that brought that reality into the New Hampshire primary and into the, ultimately into the presidential process. And as I think it filters not only just for presidential campaigns, but as you follow threads, you follow the Estes Kefauver thread straight through to today, still true today, that that's what we need in New Hampshire and that's our reputation. So what happened? Well, we know that on the Republican side, Dwight Eisenhower won. He went on to, a month later, he actually acknowledged, he thanked the people of New Hampshire for the vote, and a month or so later, he left NATO and came back and became an official candidate for president. Sherman Adams, who ran his campaign in New Hampshire, went on to run his campaign nationally, and when Eisenhower was elected in 1952, Sherman Adams went down to be his chief of staff and basically ran the White House during the Eisenhower years until 1957. On the Democratic side, Estes Kefauver won. Much to his surprise, he won. And it was like a slap in the face to the President of the United States, so that Estes Kefauver, in many ways, became a pariah to the party leadership nationally in the Democratic Party. Because, as Tom McIntyre said in an interview that I won't use here, he said nobody was happy with him for running over the old man. He ran over the old man. So, get to the Democratic Convention in 1952, even though Estes had proven, he had went on to win other presidential primaries around the country, the ballot, or the nomination went to Adlai Stevenson, and they wouldn't even get Estes the vice presidential ring. So, that was the story of Estes Kefauver, and that was the first New Hampshire primary. But you need to take a broader picture of the importance of this moment, because there were things changing in America. Things were changing in the world. And one of those was media. The media access that New Hampshire offered was different than anything that existed before because you had planes now. And you could fly from Washington to New Hampshire in an hour and a half. So that we became accessible in a way that train travel or horses or whatever didn't have. So that the Washington media establishment could come up to New Hampshire and they could follow these the race, not so much the candidates, because other than Estes Kefauver, they really weren't here that much, but they could take the reading. And then it was very picturesque. Not that Massachusetts isn't picturesque, but you know, we've got these farms and mountains and stuff, and that became part of the story. You know, it became part of the story that here are these guys, you know, we had bathrooms then. But, you know, maybe we didn't. You know, here are these out backwoods people sitting around in their corner store, you know, the country store, playing checkers in front of the potbelly stove, deciding who's going to be the next president of the United States. That was the visual that was being sent out. Newsweek, on its cover, 2 months before the primary, had a picture of a dairy farmer up in Lebanon, New Hampshire, with his barn in the backyard, basically saying, time to decide. But what was also going on at the same time was we were at the peak of the Cold War. We were in this really war of words, but war of ideas with Communist China and the Soviet Union. And the New Hampshire primary represented something that could be sent out to the world about what democracy is. You know, this is what America is all about. People at a very basic level deciding who will be their leader. So, I'm going to play next here is a newsreel from the 1952 primary. In thinking about what I said, listen for that message in this newsreel. This is America, and America is a great place because of this place, the way we vote.
Find candidates and campaign managers pulling no punches. Everyone is in there pitching in an endeavor to gauge the mood of the American people. This is the first real popularity test for the favorites, and Senator Robert A. Taft comes to New Hampshire to make his bid. Harold E. Stassen hopes for another opportunity to corral the Republican nomination. The citizens of the Granite State are not easily won. The country meeting places are hotbeds of political discussion. In village, town, and city, voters brave bitter snow and sleet to cast their votes. Eisenhower, Taft, Sasson, Warren, MacArthur, Truman, Kiefauver. It's a free country, and no armed guards to restrict your personal opinion. It was the nation's first presidential primary, and a record one. And when the ballots were totted up, it was a clean sweep for General Eisenhower on the Republican side and for Senator Estes Kiefauver heading the Democratic slate. New Hampshire has spoken, and experts are looking for more straws in the political wind.
So I have a connection to that newsreel. That last scene is at my church in Hopkinton, New Hampshire. At any rate, so you could see how this was, we were the right thing at the right moment in time. And it wasn't that we set out to do that, it just kind of happened. A series of decisions back in the 1915 and 1916, and then this new addition to it with Richard Upton's idea. And that's what we became. Now, I'm not going to focus on every primary, but I will spend a little bit of time talking, and we'll just do short clips. But it's important to kind of just follow a certain thread because Massachusetts plays a role in this too. So as I said, the Democratic Party in New Hampshire was really, was it run by Republicans? Yeah, probably not, but some people, it was a great story. But nevertheless, it was a very weak Democratic Party. And when Estes Kiefauver came into the state, he inspired people, Democrats, in a way that they hadn't really expected. Tom McIntyre, who went on to be United States Senator in 1954, ran for Congress. And in 1952, he went to the Democratic Convention as a delegate for Estes, and he was drawn in. And so Estes kind of gave this weak little party some inspiration that, yeah, maybe if you work, maybe you can make a change. In 1956, Estes Kiefauver was campaigning again, didn't get the presidential nomination, went to Adlai Stevens again, but this time the Democratic Party said, all right, we'll let you be the vice presidential candidate this time, and that's who he was. But if you know Massachusetts history, he had a little competition for that position from John F. Kennedy. Now, Kennedy called in a man named Bernie Booten, who we'll meet in the next segment. Bernie was an Estes Kiefauver supporter, and Kennedy tried to get Bernie to switch sides and vote for him, and Bernie said, no, I can't, you know, I owe my vote to Estes. But Kennedy accepted that, and a month or so after the convention in 1956, he invited Bernie down to Washington, D.C., and as Bernie would say, I spent a half an hour one-on-one with John F. Kennedy, and I would follow him anywhere from that moment on. Kennedy looked at 1960, and he saw, well, he's got this. He still, you know, he was not a well-known name at the time, but he recognized that first primary in New Hampshire, his neighboring state, if he could do really well in that, it might help push him forward through the campaign. And so one of the things he needed to do that was to have a strong Democratic Party in New Hampshire. So he picked up the little pieces that Estes Kiefauver left and he started to build the New Hampshire Democratic Party to help him get elected president. Bernie Booten became his primary person, and in 1958, Bernie ran for governor of New Hampshire to firmly establish himself as the titular head of the Democratic Party in New Hampshire. Kennedy came up to New Hampshire and made TV commercials for Bernie. I'll just mention what we'll see Bernie. When I did the interview with Bernie, right over his right shoulder, right over here is his fireplace and there's a mantle, and on top of above the mantle is an engraving of the White House. It's about this big, a beautiful engraved picture of the White House. And it was signed to Bernie, who stood by the president from the very beginning to the very end. And it was signed Jacqueline Kennedy, December 1963. Mm. That's how close Bernie was to the Kennedy family. Bernie ultimately went on to be the administrator of the General Service Administration, director of the General Service Administration, which meant that on November 23rd, 1963, his job was to clean out the Oval Office and move in the new president. At any rate, so you'll see Bernie in a minute. So you've got Kennedy building up the Democratic Party, and then you've got this guy I talked about earlier, Stiles Bridges. Stiles died in 1961, and it created a void, a vacuum in the Republican Party to fill in the leadership that he created, and it basically put the party at war. And the two lead candidates for Senate that year to replace him, one of them, the one that came in second place, Dolores Bridges, Stiles' wife, filed at the Unity Breakfast. At the Unity Breakfast with the Republican Party in 1962, she sued her opponent for unfair campaign practices at the Unity Breakfast. Now, just as another connection, that guy who won the nomination for the Republican side for Senate was a man named Perkins Bass, who was the son of Robert P. Bass, back in the early part of progressive era. At any rate, what that did was you had in 1962 the Democratic Party at the strongest it had been in many years, and the Republican Party at its weakest. The result was that New Hampshire elected a Democratic governor and a Democratic senator, and 2 years later they erected an additional congressman from the first district over on the seacoast. Yeah.
The Basses that you referred to is that family also a family of Charlie Bass, who's been a
Charlie is Perkins' son. So
Charlie Bass, the congressman.
Yeah, well, he's not congressman anymore.
But
so we have.
He's happy. Somebody a year ago. He's feeling good not being in Congress. But yes, so you have Bass 1, Bass 2, Bass 3. I don't think Charlie has any kids or anything about running. Anyway, so that's 1962. In 1964. The primary was a kind of a weird one in 1964. First of all, on the Democratic side, there was no name on the Democratic ballot. You know, we were talking 3 months after JFK had been shot, and there was no name on the Democratic ballot. The only time in the history of the New Hampshire primary that there was no name on a ballot. On the Republican side, you had the conservative wing being pushed by Barry Goldwater, and the more moderate wing being pushed for Nelson Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. And then along came this guy that decided they were going to mix it up a little bit, and they created a write-in campaign for Henry Cabot Lodge, who at that time was the United States ambassador to Vietnam. And believe it or not, the write-in campaign for Henry Cabot Lodge won. Kind of didn't change the fact that Barry Goldwater went on to be the nominee, but it disrupted things in the party, but everybody thought Lyndon Johnson was going to win anyway, so it was an interesting exercise.
So Cabot came in between Goldwater and Rockefeller.
Right.
Like, how do you win a write-in campaign in a New Hampshire primary? What did he do? What stuck out about Cabot's campaign?
Well, first of all, be clear, Henry Cabot Lodge never left Vietnam. He didn't campaign. He had nothing to do with the campaign. He had nothing to do.
He was in Vietnam.
He was in Vietnam, and these two guys were just looking for something to do. They thought there were a couple of PR guys. I think they were from down in Massachusetts. And they said, hey, let's have some fun. Let's get involved up in the primary and start a writing campaign. Henry Cabot Lodge never came to New Hampshire.
He was Nixon, running in 1860, so he was well known in that regard.
He was known. He was a senator from Massachusetts
He combines two famous Massachusetts families.
Yes.
So he wasn't nobody.
Well, what are the two families?
The Cabots and the Lodges.
So anyway, yeah, so that's what happened. It was just a write-in. All you had to do was get enough people to write in, you know? It's possible to do. Bloomberg's going to try to do it next week, but he's not going to have any success up in New Hampshire.
He's going to try it right in New Hampshire?
Bloomberg is not on our ballot.
He's not on Iowa. He wasn't on Iowa. He's not.
Not on Iowa either. Yeah. So Iowa is a different story. But New Hampshire, if Bloomberg's going to, he doesn't care, to be honest. But he's not a candidate. The only votes he's going to get are be write-in votes.
So you think a write-in campaign is still possible in New Hampshire?
No. No, I don't. But if the right person at the right moment in time came along, I think I should say it's not impossible. Actually, I won a write-in campaign in New Hampshire. I'm the supervisor of the checklist in my ward. And I didn't get in to put my name on the ballot to do it, so people would write you in. And I had like 25 people write me in. I didn't have any competition. I only needed two people to write me in. But anyway, so yeah, so you can still win an election by writing ballots.
A statewide presidential.
If you know, there's nothing there to stop it. It's all what you're capable of doing. Yeah, yeah. Well, the Goldwater, I'm sorry, the Lodge people really, they put out some really clever advertising. They show you the ballot, and they show you the arrows that would point what you needed to do. They really ran a very slick campaign. But it didn't go anywhere. Cabot Lodge stayed in Vietnam. But anyway, moving ahead to 1968. Now, I ask this question every time I give this talk, and everybody resoundingly knows the answer. What was the primary, maybe that's the wrong word to use, the principal, the most important issue in 1968?
Vietnam.
Everybody, yeah. Vietnam. And so on the Democratic side, we're not going to talk about the Republican side. We're going to just talk about the Democratic side on this, not because I'm a Democrat or anything else, just because that's where the more interesting story is. So you have Lyndon Johnson, who's president, and then you've got this guy, Gene McCarthy, who comes along and says he's going to make a statement. McCarthy did not decide to do this until November of 1967. It's not a long window. Primary was in March, so he had about four months. But he was going to come up, and it was really not so much a campaign for a candidate as an idea, as a statement. And so this is the story of that primary. But it's also part of the thread that starts with us, is Kefauver.
You almost knew it was futile, but the statement had to be made about the war. And for many, many people, it was not the man who wants to be president, but an issue that people were increasingly concerned about. And he's the one who brought it before us.
And there were some of the votes for people who felt that the war hadn't been pursued strongly enough or successfully enough. So it was anti-Johnson in that respect. Not exactly peace people, but who felt that the war was a failure. And there were some who thought it was Joe McCarthy.
In 68, it was very evident to me that one of the things we needed was to revitalize the party. You could see ragged edges all over the place.
10 years earlier, Bernie Booten had led a new generation of Democrats to control of the state party. Now another generation was about to challenge the status quo and the presidential administration that had brought Democrats to power in the state.
So it really was my suggestion to have Senator McIntyre and Governor King as co-chairman of the campaign. They're good friends to begin with. Our top office holders in New Hampshire. And hopefully this would provide a unifying base. So instead of two teams, maybe there'd be one team.
First of all, we've been told that we were committing treason by the senator, our Democratic senator, and the governor, the Democratic governor.
And people in the state committee.
In the state committee, yeah. To the point of treason. Mm. Yeah. That we would have no political futures whatsoever. If we had any political ambitions to get about it, we were committing political suicide.
There was a difference between Washington and New Hampshire. And yet if John King said something, you had to stick by what he said. And that's what got you in trouble, whether you admit it or not.
He accused McCarthy of lack of patriotism. And when they asked me this out of the cold, I didn't know what the King had said. But I remember saying, I don't think that's fair. I don't think that regardless of McCarthy and what he's saying, that he isn't still a patriot in every sense of the word. And that got us in trouble immediately, because the next morning I was down in Hampton somewhere, or down Hampton Beach or something, and we got a call from the gang saying, hey, King's up in arms, you contradicted him. And I think that's where I kind of mushed out a little bit. I tried to squeal off it. And it was a very difficult thing to get involved in the last stage of that campaign as far as knocking McCarthy around. It wasn't working.
In fact, McCarthy had no competition, for Lyndon Johnson's name wasn't on the ballot. His was a write-in campaign. But both sides were aggressively out to win. The Johnson people blanketed the state with numbered pledge cards for people to sign, While the McCarthy people used radio advertising, movie stars, and busloads of out-of-state college students.
Keep clean with Jean.
Yes, yeah.
We were a little nervous about the kids who were, the hair was too long or a little too rough looking. So they were put in cellars on telephones.
They were not.
Writing envelopes and postcards and doing that kind of thing. There was a screening process. They weren't allowed to go out and look, knock on doors unless they were reasonably shaved and haircut. Saved up a little.
Whatever they did, they all worked so hard. And I think the thing they were so valuable for was the door-to-door campaigning that they did. They went into every possible neighborhood that they could. Really.
By 1968, personal campaigning in New Hampshire was no longer a novelty. It was expected. While Johnson ignored the state, McCarthy made sure the voters of New Hampshire had a chance to meet him.
He was more articulate and intelligent than many a politician that I've ever seen. And that appealed to some of us, to others, that was a turnoff. However, he was a very, very gracious, friendly man. And I think anybody that he met personally was charmed by him. And don't you?
Oh, yeah.
I think
that,
and the fact that he bothered, as I said earlier, to go into funny little places to meet people.
Lyndon Johnson was the actual winner, receiving 49% of the vote. However, McCarthy, who was only supposed to get 10%, ended up with 41% and a decisive moral victory.
So as a note, did anybody pick up on the little headline right over here about Johnson and delegates? You were watching this pretty close. You didn't see it?
I didn't.
It said Johnson only scores 4 delegates. That's because in 1968, it was still just a beauty contest. There was no connection between what a candidate got in the presidential race and how many delegates they got to the convention. 2 different elections. You voted for the candidate for president, and then you voted for the delegates to the convention. And the McCarthy people played it really smart, and they won almost all of the New Hampshire delegates to the 1968 New Hampshire delegation. And, as you just heard, it was a write-in vote for Johnson. So there we are, 1968, another write-in vote takes the cake. But what's most important is that in 68, for the second time, we've given a slap in the face to the president. You know, Johnson 2 weeks later took himself out of the race for presidency. Not quite as dramatic as Kefauver, but, you know, for 3-4 primaries since 1952, we had cruised along, and now people are starting to say, wait a minute, who are these people from New Hampshire? What are they doing? What right do they have to embarrass the president? What right do they have to be first? So it was after the 68 primary that the discussion first started about whether New Hampshire should be first. Now, in the meantime, people started looking ways to check into it. So Iowa created a caucus system, which came into play in 1972 for the first time. But nobody tried to challenge the primary. So now we move to 72. Now, I'm going to tell you who the two front candidates were, again on the Democratic side. I'm going to see what you have to say about one of them. Muskie and George McGovern. Ed Muskie and George McGovern. So what was, in terms of defining moments in that election, or in that primary, what was the defining moment? You're all going to know it as soon as I say it.
Muskie appearing to cry.
Remember that? Did Muskie cry? Muskie cry in front of the union leader office up in Manchester. You got it. You must have been sitting up. Are you from New Hampshire? You just drift down here?
No, but I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Little junkie was living near the border.
All right. So, and then the second question I'll ask is, who won the 1972 New Hampshire primary? George McGovern or Ed Muskie?
Muskie.
One Muskie. Anybody else want to jump on the Muskie wagon?
That's counterintuitive, so it's probably where it's going. I don't know for sure.
All right. We'll let it be. You're going to have to watch the piece. Now, in this section about the 72 primary, which I feel is one of the most important sections in this talk, because it separates out perception and reality. It's going to tell about the Muskie crying, how that came to be, And that, in many ways, was sent out a perception for people. But what really happens, and it transitions, what really happens is how a campaign needs to be run. And you'll see that, you'll see how that happens.
The union leader, whether you agreed with us, you hated us, we were a conscience of the state. We still were there to say, aha, this guy is a thief, this guy is stealing, take a look at this, take a look at that. You know, there aren't a lot of newspapers that have the guts to go out and crusade.
The Manchester Union Leader is New Hampshire's largest and only statewide daily newspaper, a potent force in itself. But it was made all the more powerful by its outspoken conservative publisher, William Loeb.
Bill Loeb loved politics. He loved politics as the game of politics. He grew up with politics. He loved the give and take. He loved the power of politics.
They provided a lot of the anti-Muskie ammunition, no question about it. No question about it. They just hammered at it every day, every day.
Politically, we're at the other end of the spectrum. Yeah, because we were out of what was the liberal mainstream. But that didn't mean that we were bad, didn't mean that we were evil, it didn't mean that we did one thing different than any other newspaper, any television channel. We were just looking at it from a different side of the spectrum. We were looking at it from the right, everyone else was looking at it from the left.
In those days it was very bad to be a hippie. They would go and photograph hippies in front of the Muskie campaign. You know, I don't know whether it was put up or not. You know, you don't know. But they really did everything they could.
I never wrote a word that wasn't true. I never misquoted anyone.
Loeb doesn't like Muskie, and Loeb has been told that Muskie has a short fuse. And Loeb is going to see if he can light this fuse.
Anti-Muskie editorials in the Union Leader were routine, but in February 1972, the Union Leader printed a letter suggesting that Muskie had used the term Canuck to refer to people of French-Canadian heritage.
In Loeb's defense, Loeb ran every letter he got, unless it was clearly libelous. And Loeb got a lot of political letters on any subject, and I think part of Loeb's mindset was, wow, this is great. This is great stuff to get Muskie with.
When issues approached, we wrote up San Juan Hill. We didn't just sit around and do nothing about it. And one of his favorite comments would always be, we can be anything, but I'll be damned if we're going to be dull.
The letter was followed the next day by an editorial page reprint of an article from Newsweek magazine in which Muskie's wife Jane revealed a more laid-back personality. Ed Muskie's fuse had been lit. On a snowy Saturday morning, 10 days before the primary, he held a rally in front of the Union Leader office.
By attacking me, by attacking my wife, he's proved himself to be a gutless coward.
I think he lost it. I don't know whether he actually cried, but he obviously got overcome with emotion. Now, why didn't he go to Newsweek in New York, pull his flatbed truck up, and have Osborne Elliott come down? You gutless coward, stop picking on my wife. That wasn't going to get him any votes in New Hampshire. He thought he was going to do something to spark his campaign. Instead, it blew up in his face. I called William Lewis and said, what do you think of this guy? He said, geez, a guy like that gets emotional over a little old newspaper publisher? I don't want a guy like that with his finger on the nuclear button.
Oh, yeah, every time it comes up to this day, when people hear that I worked on the Muskie campaign, the first thing they say is, oh, too bad he cried. He was a good man, too bad he cried. I had that just the other day, somebody said that. People still say that. But it really wasn't why I lost.
Your campaign, from an organizer's point of view, can be perfection. But it doesn't move unless the candidate transmits a jolt of electricity to it.
Because then people would come during the campaign, I can't tell you how many times, oh, he's not like he was on the TV. And they were comparing the thrill they got, you know, from seeing him on the tube cutting Nixon down to size and remembering how excited and thrilled they were. And it didn't measure up. You know, they were disappointed.
He went shake hands at the polls. And he went up to this one young woman standing, I think it was Ward 6 in Manchester, as I remember. And he said, "My name is George McGovern." And she said, "This is the sixth time I've met you."
His wife wouldn't let us schedule him as much as we wanted to. Jane Muskie took care of him. She took care of that man. He had to have a nap, you know, in the middle of the afternoon. And the other candidates were going 24 hours a day, but Ed was having his rest.
The New Hampshire primary demonstrated a new phenomenon in 1968 by being an election a candidate could win by perception rather than actual votes. Perception would also play a role in 1972. Simply receiving the most votes would not be enough for Ed Muskie to be declared the winner.
What Muskie was running against was not an arbitrary percentage, but an expectation that as the front runner from a neighboring state, he would do very well here. And if Muskie had run a good campaign here and had fallen a few percentage points short of 50%, I don't think anything much would have been made of it.
Ed Muskie won New Hampshire. The fact that he got less than 50%, that perception, they should have never allowed the perception to go out across the country that he had lost. When Muskie got up to speak that evening, he did not accept the mantle of victory the way he should have, because they had preconditioned themselves along the lines that they were going to get this unusually high percentage of the vote. And because he got, what did he wind up with, 49.6 or something like that? You know, he won. So much of it is the perception of.
In the final count, George McGovern received 35% of the vote to Ed Muskie's 45%. McGovern, who had built his campaign on doing well in New Hampshire, never lost the momentum and went on to be the Democratic nominee in 1972.
So you could say, as we heard last night, it's all in the victory speech. Claim it. Always claim it. Now, let's talk about a couple things at two different levels. First of all, that evolution of the primary. You know, McGovern just took what Estes Kefauver did, what Gene McCarthy did, and expanded it a little bit. He brought some new elements to it. McGovern started working the state a year before the primary. That was unheard of, with the exception of Kennedy. And Kennedy really wasn't up here that much. But McGovern was, spent a lot of time in the state, working it, meeting people, getting to know people. And then look at McCarthy bringing in movie stars, college students. Well, you have the same thing happening for George McGovern. So it just kept building how to run these campaigns. What is New Hampshire like? What works in New Hampshire? And you could take somebody like George McGovern, who in the beginning of 1971 was zero in terms of percentage in the polls, and he could build up something. And once you broke that barrier in New Hampshire, you got the ride. You keep going. Now, on the other side of the equation is, what about other people outside of the state? Third time the Democratic Party gave a slap to the front, the guy that was supposed to be the nominee. You know, two presidents and now Muskie. Muskie was, you know, had been preordained as the Democratic candidate in 1972, and this just was the beginning of the end of his campaign. So now this power structure in the Democratic Party and outside of New Hampshire is saying even more. Why are they first? Who do they think they are? Why do we do this? Why do we tolerate this? I want a piece of that action. Florida decided to have its own primary the same day as New Hampshire. Listen, now we're talking, we're going to take the window between 72 and 80. Florida decided to have its primary the same day as New Hampshire. New Hampshire moved its day to primary, moved town meeting day a week ahead. So suddenly we were ahead of. Next one, Massachusetts. Started talking about in other states, let's have a New England primary. We'll do it in New England. We'll all be a part of this thing. I'll come to New England. We'll all be part of it. Well, the New Hampshire legislature passed a law. New Hampshire will have its election, primary election, 1 week earlier than any other state in New England. Florida came back and tried it again. New Hampshire passed another, had amended the law. I shouldn't say they passed, they amended the law. New Hampshire will have its primary 1 week earlier than any other state. And that's what is still in place to this day. New Hampshire's law says we will have our primary 1 week earlier than any other state. And as you know, it's been fought over a little bit. You know, we've been challenged. We've had the primary as early as in 2008. It was the second week in January. But we still hold on.